Good evening. So finally the sun shines after a grey week, and the BBC Philharmonic have brought the sun and heat of Spain with them this evening, albeit Spain themed partly through French eyes. BBC Phil on stage in front of me. They arrived earlier today from Salford. This is the first prom that they prepared in their new base at Media City, and it's the prom's debut of their new chief conductor, Juanjo Mena. He's from the Basque region of Spain, indeed still lives there with his family. Ravel was of Basque descent through his mother, and tonight we'll hear two of his great contributions to the repertoire of Franco-Hispanic music, Rhapsody Español and Albarada del Gracioso. There is one truly Spanish composer on the bill, Manuel de Falla. After the interval, pianist Stephen Osborne will play Nights in the Gardens of Spain, which take us on an evocative journey through Andalusia with stops at Granada and Cordoba. And spread right across the programme this evening, Debussy's triptych Image, that takes us on another journey, this time one that crosses international boundaries. The three works in Image each reflect a different country, later France and Spain. We start with England and Jig, which adopts the gently lilting traditional jig. A wistful solo oboe d'amore sets the mood and introduces the Northumbrian tune, The Keel Row. We never quite hear it complete, though. The nearest we get to it is a version played by the xylophone that leads to the main climax. The use of Keel Row by Debussy apparently inspired by Streets, a poem that Verlaine had written while visiting the Soho district of London. He then chosen to set his words to Keel Row. One of the themes bringing together tonight's prom is that most of the work started out as sets of pieces for solo or double piano, no exception with Image, set of solo piano pieces written in 1905. The orchestral Image started out as two piano works, and later he decided to opt for the multicoloured palette offered by the orchestra. Three works that we're hearing tonight finished in October 1912. Well, that applause was for Yuri Tuchinsky, leader of the BBC Philharmonic, taking his place. And here comes Juanjo Mena, the new chief conductor of the BBC Philharmonic, to open our concert with Jig from Debussy's Image. The British panel of Debussy's triptych Image, Gig, originally called Gig Triste, Sad Jigs, but later Debussy decided he didn't want to tell listeners what to think and changed the title. We're left alone now to come up with our own interpretation of the piece. The Keel Row, that Northumbrian folk tune utilised there, also arranged by Percy Grainger, who died 50 years ago this year, died in 1961. And the spotlight falls on his music on August the 2nd, including a whole late-night prom, bbc.co.uk/proms, for more details of our Grainger celebration here at the Royal Albert Hall. The other Image, Ronde Printemps and Iberia, coming up later tonight. Next, though, another Spain-loving Frenchman, Ravel, and his Rhapsody Espagnole. It was written at the same time as Debussy was working on Image, and like it, it also started out as music for two pianos. We start with a prelude to the night, a musical tone that suggests deepening darkness and mystery, perhaps even a little danger. But this is a night that is as beautiful as it is frightening. Then comes Malaguena, which takes its name from a fandango-like dance performed in Malaga. Rather dreamy affair, only when the cor anglais takes over the theme is there a sense of waking up. The third movement, Habanera, was written a decade earlier, inspired by Bizet's opera Carmen. And to finish, Festival, Feria, a great party, given the marking by Ravel, rather animated. So returning to the stage, Juanjo Mena, to conduct the BBC Philharmonic here at the Proms in Ravel's Rhapsody Espagnole. A great festive party ending Ravel's Rhapsody Espanol Feria. Before it, we heard the Habanera, Malagueña, and Prelude to the Night, which started it so mysteriously. Ravel's Rhapsody Espanol, played by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted here at the Proms by Juanjo Mena. Now, therefore, Gillian Callow, principal cor anglais pair in the orchestra, taking a bow. Bassoonists led by David Chatwin. Whole of the woodwind section up now. Trumpet, horns. Now the whole orchestra rises to its feet. Music for two pianos orchestrated by Ravel in 1907 and 1908 while he worked on his comic opera with a Spanish setting, Le Espagnol. Well, this is BBC Radio 3, live at the Proms this Friday night, the start of a weekend that takes us on a journey encompassing Papua New Guinea, Mongolia, Greenland and Zambia. The Human Planet Prom is tomorrow night, and then again on Sunday morning. And on Sunday evening, Verdi's Requiem, conducted by Semyon Bychkov. Four soloists joined by the BBC Symphony Chorus, the BBC National Chorus of Wales and the London Philharmonic Choir as well, live on Radio 3 on Sunday night. Well, later in tonight's prom, Iberia from Debussy's Image. That'll end the concert. We're going to conclude the first half with his impressions of France. Ronde de Printemps. There's an epigram on the score which translates as Long live May. The month of May is welcome with her savage banner. Comes from a French book on Dante, but Roger Nichols, the great French music expert, writes in the programme tonight that there may also be an Italian influence to this piece. Debussy may have also had lines from the Florentine poet Cavalcanti in his mind. The line, because I think not ever to return to Tuscany. Don't get too obsessed, Nichols counsels, with the Frenchness of this music. Perhaps it's only as French as Giga English and Iberia is Spanish. Well, the movement starts with a single note that shimmers. The thing about this piece, wrote Debussy, is that it is immaterial and that as a result one cannot treat it like a robust symphony marching along on its 4 feet. Popular French song courses through the movement, but it's the rich tapestry of the orchestra that surely leaves the biggest impression. Here is Juanjo Mena once again returning to the platform to conduct the BBC Philharmonic in Ronde de Printemps from Debussy's Image. Thank you. Ronde de Printemps by Debussy from Images. Juan Jomena conducting the BBC Philharmonic. Piece that was first heard here at the Proms exactly 100 years ago in what was its UK premiere. Henry Wood conducted it in what was a remarkable concert, not, of course, here at the Royal Albert Hall, but at the Queen's Hall. Also featured Jascha Heifetz in Elgar's then relatively recent violin concerto. And Heifetz was then joined by Pablo Casals to play Brahms' double concerto. Richard Davis, principal flautist of the orchestra, taking a bow there. And Jomena is back on the platform. Actually, September that he officially becomes the new chief conductor of the BBC Philharmonic, taking over from Gianandrea Nozeda, who will be here for two concerts later on in this year's prom season. Juan Jomena brings his entire orchestra to its feet now, looking out at what's a capacity crowd at the Royal Albert Hall this Friday night. Well, Iberia, written as the central movement of Images and a triptych in its own right, will conclude our prom this Friday. Immediately after the interval, Ravel's Alborada del Gracioso, a piano work orchestrated for Diaghilev and first heard in London, in fact, in 1919. And in a programme of works originally for piano or pianos, we will actually get to hear the instrument for real as Stephen Osborne plays Fallier's Nights in the Gardens of Spain. All that coming up after the interval, during which, looking ahead to those gardens of Spain, Graham Fife takes us on a virtual tour of one of them. In tonight's 20 minutes, he follows in the footsteps of Washington Irving, who in the late 1820s sojourned for some months in Granada, and there, in the grounds of the magnificent Alhambra, enjoyed the sweetness of the garden.
In the spring of 1829, Washington Irving,
whom curiosity had brought to Spain,
as he puts it,
made a rambling expedition from Seville to wander among the romantic mountains of Andalusia to Granada.
Well known both in America and England as the author of Rip Van Winkle and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, he'd come initially to Madrid at the invitation of the American minister in Spain in 1826. The immediate object of his visit, the newly opened archive in the Spanish capital, eventually led to what we'd call a historical novel based on the voyages of Christopher Columbus. But it was his journey through Andalusia, as the Moors called southern Spain, that acquainted him with
a stern and melancholy country, with rugged mountains and long sweeping plains, silent and lonesome, partaking of the savage and solitary character of Africa.
Travelling by mule, he observed the vulture and eagle wheeling about the mountain cliffs, the shy bustard stalking about the heaths, and myriads of smaller birds flitting through orchards and gardens.
But though a great part of Spain is deficient in the garniture of groves and forests and the softer charms of ornamental cultivation, yet its scenery is noble in its severity and in unison with the attributes of its people. And I think I better understand the proud, hardy, frugal, and abstemious Spaniard, his manly defiance of hardships and contempt of effeminate indulgences, since I see the country he inhabits. The Spanish muleteer has an inexhaustible stock of songs and ballads with which to beguile his incessant wayfaring. Old traditional romances about the Moors, or some legend of a saint, some love ditty, or, more frequently, some ballad about a bold contrabandista or hardy bandolero. For the smuggler and the robber are poetical heroes among the common people of Spain. This talent of singing and improvising is said to have been inherited from the Moors. And how many songs and ballads, Arabian and Spanish, of love and war and chivalry are associated with the Alhambra.
His first glimpse of the fabled city, the former capital of a province of the Caliphate of Cordoba, was memorable. It was on a cloudless day, the heat of the sun tempered by cool breezes from the mountains, when the small company entered the glorious Vega, the fertile plain, and Irving saw, in the distance,
romantic Granada, surmounted by the ruddy towers of the Alhambra,
the red one in Arabic,
while far above it the snowy summits of the Sierra Nevada,
the snowy mountains,
shone like silver.
Moorish domination in Spain endured for over 7 centuries. The city of Córdoba itself became a great centre of learning, drawing scholars from the 3 religions of the book, Jewish, Christian and Islamic. The heritage of Arabic builders, masons and designers in Andalusia is pronounced. Irving sat one evening in the Alhambra, contemplating its fairy architecture.
Watching the effect of the declining daylight upon this Moorish pile, I was led into a consideration of the light, elegant and voluptuous character prevalent throughout its internal architecture, and to contrast it with the grand but gloomy solemnity of the Gothic edifices reared by the Spanish conquerors. The very architecture thus bespeaks the opposite and irreconcilable natures of the 2 warlike peoples who so long battled here for mastery of the peninsula.
That battle ended with the conquest of Granada, the expulsion of the Moors, and the unification of Spain by Ferdinand and Isabella in 1492. In the preceding century, Granada had experienced a period of cultural brilliance, to which the royal palaces and gardens of the Alhambra bear lasting testimony. One summer, my daughter and I followed in Irving's steps and walked up the long hill from the middle of town to stroll through the impossibly lavish chambers, porticos and tranquil gardens of the Alhambra. All in all, a confection of opulent hyperbole, what an Arab poet called
a pearl set in emeralds.
Extending the original fortress, the Alcazaba, built 500 years earlier, the palatial apartments are wonders of spacious, light-filled rooms, intricately carved and moulded ornament, umbrageous porticos and arcades, cool pavements, gardens stocked with perfumed flowers and plants, and glossy-leaved trees in company with ever-flowing fountains, streams and formal basins of abundant water. Water in the desert. Water was an essential of life, but also, when in plenteous supply, to the peoples of the desert, and to the Arabs in particular, a potent emblem of luxury. In his Tales of the Alhambra, Irving tells how
an abundant supply of water, brought by old Moorish aqueducts, circulates through the palace, supplying its baths and fish pools, sparkling in jets within its halls, or murmuring in channels along the marble pavements. When it has paid tribute to the royal pile and visited its gardens and parterre, it flows down the long avenue leading to the city, tinkling in rills, gushing in fountains, and maintaining a perpetual verdure in those groves that embower and beautify the whole hill of the Alhambra.
And it's not just the coolness imparted by water and its remedy of thirst, but the voluptuous sound of water, the sluice and gurgle, and the scintillant glitter of water drops in radiant light, which so enhance the sense in the Alhambra of a welcome refuge from the glare of a pitiless sun. The Moors of Granada applied a remarkable engineering inventiveness to moving water from the mountain sources via aqueducts lined with impervious beds of clay to cisterns both for vital supply and pleasing effect. The water in the garden ponds is constantly replenished, but by an ingenious system of underground in- and outflow pipes, its surface remains still, thus to reflect a perfect, unruffled image of the surrounding buildings. Those buildings cast shade in summer to render the open place cooler. The flaying heat of southern Spain is intense, unbearable, cruel, and, as Irving puts it not entirely fancifully,
the delicate airs from the Sierra Nevada play through these lofty halls, bringing with them the sweetness of the surrounding gardens.
He hits there on an important element in the nature of the Alhambra's layout, that to the reality of coolness is added the illusion of more coolness, the moving waters of the fountains which sing of refreshment. The water stairway leading down from one of the Alhambra gardens is a lovely example of Moorish wizardry. Water flows down the open stone conduits in the elbow-high parapets to either side of the steps, like a fluid handrail. Contemporary Arab poets were, accordingly, ebullient in their praise of water. This, from the poem of the Fountain of Daraja's Garden, also known as the Garden of the Orange Trees and the Garden of the Marbles.
I am a water orb, limpid and clear. A great ocean whose shores are made of fine marble, whose waters, like pearls, flow across an enormous, delicately carved sheet of ice. Sometimes I overflow with water. At other times, I separate from the transparent veil that covers me. Then I and the water that issues from the borders of the fountain appear like a piece of ice, part of which melts and part does not, like a star-studded sky. I am also mother of pearl, my droplets like those pearls placed by the goldsmith on Ibn Nasr's crown.
Ibn Nasr was the first sultan of the Nasrid dynasty, which ruled Granada from 1238 until the Reconquista, and the poem is one of many which form calligraphic decoration of the walls of the Alhambra palaces. The garden was actually built for the Emperor Charles V in the early 16th century, in the Moorish pattern of shady trees, cypress, acacia and orange, and box hedges grouped round a central marble fountain. The effect is of gracious ease, a peaceful corner, overlooked by the windows of the Mirador of Lindaraja. Four halls leading off the Daraja garden are known now as the Washington Irving Chambers. For shortly after his arrival in Granada, the famous American author was invited to stay in the Alhambra by its governor. It was in these apartments,
a rambling set of empty, unfurnished rooms,
which he occupied for several months, attended to by Antonia, the palace chatelaine, that he wrote most of his tales of the Alhambra. In this book, a memoir of his residence in the ancient royal abode, the routine of his days, the manner of his work, anecdotes of the people he met, he also relates stories culled from his researches in the Jesuit library, part of the University of Granada, and tales out of that ancient Moorish tradition, best known from A Thousand and One Nights.
Though fond of passing the greater part of my day alone, yet I occasionally repair in the evenings to the little domestic circle of Doña Antonia. This is generally held in an old Moorish chamber, which serves the good dame for parlour, kitchen, and hall of audience, which must have boasted of some splendour in the time of the Moors. But a rude fireplace has been made in modern times in one corner, the smoke from which has discoloured the walls and almost obliterated the ancient arabesques. A window with a balcony, overhanging the valley of the Darro, lets in the cool evening breeze. And here I take my frugal supper of fruit and milk, and mingle with the conversation of the family. There is a natural talent or mother wit about the Spaniards, which renders them intellectual and agreeable companions, whatever may be their condition of life, or however imperfect may have been their education. Add to this, they are never vulgar. Nature has endowed them with an inherent dignity of spirit.
The palace itself captivated him. He trod, as he puts it, haunted ground, and was surrounded by romantic associations, not all comfortable. The hall of the Abenzarquis is so named for a distinguished noble family who were, it said, massacred here just before the fall of Granada. Wrongly accused of conspiracy against the ruling Sultan Boabdil, the Abenzarquis, says Irving,
went down with the foundering wreck of Muslim domination, leaving nothing behind them but a gallant and romantic name.
And according to legend, an indelible stain of their spilled blood in the hall's pavement. The exquisite decor of the room belies the sinister connection. The arches over the doorways are detailed with intricately carved ornamental knots. The windows are framed with fretwork, and the canopy beneath a star-shaped dome is hung with pendants, the characteristic mocharabes, like gem-encrusted stalactites, which adorn many ceilings in the Alhambra. On them is picked out a dedicatory prayer.
There is no other help than the help that comes from God, the clement and merciful one. When I rise in the morning, Pepe, the stuttering lad from the gardens, brings me a tribute of freshly culled flowers, which are afterwards arranged in vases by the skilful hand of Dolores, who takes a feminine pride in the decoration of my chambers. My meals are made wherever caprice dictates, sometimes in one of the Moorish halls, sometimes under the arcade of the Court of Lions, surrounded by flowers and fountains. And when I walk out, I am conducted by the assiduous Matteo to the most romantic retreats of the mountains and delicious haunts of the adjacent valleys, not one of which but is the scene of some wonderful tale.
The rectangular patio, or court, of the Lions is flanked by arcades and the enclave of royal living quarters. On the base of its fountain, a bowl supported by 12 crudely carved lions, Irving surmises the journeyman work of a Christian captive, is engraved a celebratory poem. Irving was warned, as have I been, that the aroma of Arabic poetry is all but lost in translation. Still, the English does at least hint at a subtle and sensual interlacing of idea, image, and melodious oral evocation.
Are there not marvels in this garden, which God has made incomparable in beauty? A sculpture of pearls of transparent clarity, whose edges are trimmed with dewdrops. Melted silver runs between the pearls, which it resembles in its white, pure beauty. Water and marble seem to be one, and we cannot know which of them is moving. Do not you see how the water spills on the basin and immediately gushes from the spouts? It is a lover whose eyelids brim over with tears, tears masked for fear lest they betray.
Another paradise just outside the Alhambra complex, the famous hanging garden of the Generalife Palace, is the subject of the first movement of De Falla's symphonic impressions. It has been replanted just as it was in the time of the Moors. Standing beyond the Alhambra on higher ground where cooler breezes circulate, the Generalife formed part of the royal summer residence, and the garden with its long pool and water sprays, its basins and fountains, is stocked with aromatic plants and shrubs, adding the trance of perfume to the blessing of coolness. Orange and lemon trees, bay, myrtle and sweet-smelling viburnum, the musk of roses, violets and pungent herbs. Arab poets draw on the imagery of gardens for their rhapsodies of love. A woman may be
like a willow, green, supple and fresh, teased by the hands of the wind and the rain.
And in the religion of Islam, the enjoyment of gardens is a divine reward. A verse in the Quran reads,
those who believe and do good works will enter gardens below which rivers will flow eternally for them. They will enter the cool shade.
Such promise to a nomadic people, want to travel by night to avoid the blistering ferocity of the desert sun's relentless heat, was heady indeed. And in the Alhambra, the notion of paradise and earth was made reality. Irving succumbed readily to their seductive charm. When he arrived in May, the gardens were green, the foliage of the trees still tender and transparent, the pomegranate, which gives its name to Granada, in vivid crimson bloom, the orchards of the Darro Valley in full blossom, the rocks hung with wildflowers, and everywhere
a wilderness of roses,
among which nightingales sang, at night and all day long. As the parching summer advanced, the rose withered, and the nightingales fell mute, although snow lay yet on the mountain peaks, a constant source of ice for the city, and, says Irving,
a perennial verdure reigned immediately round the city. But such is the nature of Spain. Wild and stern, the moment it escapes from cultivation, the desert and the garden are ever side by side. One night of full moon, the garden beneath my window was gently lighted up. The orange and citron trees were tipped with silver. The fountain sparkled in the moonbeams, and even the blush of the rose was faintly visible. I now felt the poetic merit of the Arabic inscription on the walls. How beauteous is this garden, where the flowers of the earth vie with the stars of heaven. What can compare with the vase of yon alabaster fountain filled with crystal water? Nothing but the moon in her fullness, shining in the midst of an unclouded sky. On such heavenly nights I would sit for hours at my window, inhaling the sweetness of the garden, and musing on the checkered fortunes of those whose history was dimly shadowed out in the elegant memorial all around. The temperature of a summer midnight in Andalusia is perfectly ethereal. We seem lifted up into a purer atmosphere. We feel a serenity of soul, a buoyancy of spirits, an elasticity of frame which render mere existence happiness. But when moonlight is added to all this, the effect is like enchantment. Under its plastic sway, the Alhambra seems to regain its pristine glories.
He was perhaps sitting at the Mirador of Lindaraja. The window is low, because the custom was to recline on a couch or ottoman and gaze out from the airy shadiness of the high-ceilinged room over the lush bounty of the garden. From this very window, Aisha, mother of Boabdil, the last sultan, watched her son surrender the bastion of Granada, all that remained of Muslim Spain, to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. As Islamic tradition has it,
the Moor's last sigh.
When Boabdil returned to the Alhambra in tears, his mother rebuked him.
You do well to weep as a woman over what you could not defend as a man.
We cannot duplicate Irving's experience of a near-deserted Alhambra. We come as tourists to a sort of fable, both magical, maybe a bit vulgar, an extravagance of improbable dimension, but a place of unique otherness. We may wonder what curious reality its residents occupied, except that this was their vision of royalty, as removed from common existence as the garden is from the desert. Irving was luxuriating in the cool hall of the baths when a letter was brought,
summoning me away from my Muslim Elysium to mingle once more in the bustle and business of the dusty world.
In fact, on his appointment as secretary to the American legation in London, he wrote,
"It was indeed a sorrowful parting."
The Sweetness of the Garden, tonight's 20 Minutes, was written and presented by Graham Fife. The readings were by James Lely, and the producer was Paul Kobrak. It's just gone 8:30 on BBC Radio 3 this Friday night. This is Petroc Trelawney welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall. We're off to our own gardens of Spain in about 10 minutes' time. Cordoba and Granada, the locations visited in Falla's work, which will be played by Stephen Osborne. BBC Philharmonic and Juanjo Mena are giving tonight's concert. Later we'll hear the last of Debussy's Image, Iberia, a piece that brims over with Spanish character and spontaneity as ever. If you want to know more about the music that we're hearing this evening, you can access Proms programme notes at bbc.co.uk/proms. French music, written since 1900, is one of the major themes at the Proms this year, reflected in all sorts of different ways. Earlier this week we heard Messiaen and the UK premiere of Pascal Dussopin's Morning on Long Island in a concert by the Radio France Philharmonic Orchestra. And there are five pieces each this season by Henri Dutilleux and five pieces by Ravel, and one of Ravel's right now, Alborada del Gracioso. Most of the music that we're hearing tonight started out life as pieces for either piano or two pianos, and Alborada is no exception. It started out as one of Ravel's Miroirs, first played by his friend Ricardo Vignes in Paris in 1906. Ravel didn't simply transcribe his piano music, however, he completely rewrote it. Pianists would never say this, I guess, but to many music lovers, the originals were just the sketches. It's the orchestral version that's the real thing. Well, Dawn Song of a Jester is how Alborada del Gracioso is normally translated, a morning piece designed to wake slumbering lovers. The music's basically an extended song framed with two bouts of dance music. The orchestration happened when the great impresario Diaghilev, who premiered Daphnis and Chloe, decided to put on a mixed bill with his Ballet Russe here in London, called Le Menin, after Velázquez's painting. The show opened at the Alhambra Theatre in 1919, using music by Chabrier, Fauré's Pavane, and the arrangement of Alborada that Diaghilev had commissioned from Ravel. Well, the orchestra just tuning now on the platform, Yuri Tuchinsky. long-standing leader of the BBC Philharmonic, is on its feet at the moment. It's the bassoon that takes on the role of the singing jester. The scale of the orchestra, absolutely enormous when you remember this was once just a solo piano piece. But I suppose for Ravel, absolutely everything had changed. When he wrote this for piano in 1905, I'm thinking in one direction. When he came round to orchestrating it, the war had happened in which he'd served. His life had changed utterly, and his music would never be the same again. So the orchestra tuned, and we wait for a sense of calm to fall over the Royal Albert Hall as we continue our Franco-Spanish Friday night at the Proms with the BBC Philharmonic. And here is Juan Omena, bringing the BBC Philharmonic to its feet, making his way centre stage to conduct Ravel's Alborada del Gracioso. Thank you. Albarada del Gracioso, Dawn Song of the Jester by Ravel. Played by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Juanjo Mena. Written as a piano piece in 1904 and 1905, and then orchestrated after the end of the First World War. Well, during the interval this evening, a piano was moved onto the stage, ready for our next piece, Nights in the Gardens of Spain, Manuel de Falla's wonderfully evocative portrayal of the gardens of the Generalife, Gypsy Festival in Córdoba, and in between a dance with a hint of the Malaguena, that dance from Malaga that we heard earlier on during Rhapsody Español. The work is played this evening by Stephen Osborne.
I mean, it's such a beautiful piece. It's a very unusual one in terms of the balance between piano and orchestra, because it's not really a piano concerto. At times the piano is very important, and then at other times, for quite lengthy sections, the piano doesn't really do very much. You have a very strong sense of shared responsibility with the conductor. You know, the pianist can't make the piece work without the conductor really having a good sense of the shape, which I'm delighted to say today with Juanjo Mena. That is not going to be a problem at all, because he feels this music so deeply.
The whole piece paints a wonderful picture, doesn't it? I mean, you can almost imagine the gardens. You can sort of smell them, you can feel them. You can get that feeling of being late at night or the different times of day.
You know, the opening of the piece particularly is something that is just so incredibly atmospheric. And like within like 3 or 4 seconds, you're put into a very, very particular kind of world, which is, like you say, very sultry. But there's a real sort of Spanish dignity in it as well. It's funny, in a lot of Spanish music, there's a very strong backbone to it, even in this, you know, very quiet opening. You know, the sort of rhythm and the character is so important.
Stephen Osborne talking to me this afternoon. Tess Knighton writing in tonight's programme saying that Falla, without doubt the most important Spanish composer of the 20th century, came from Cadiz, started out playing in local bars and salons. Later his family fell on hard times and moved to Madrid, where he started composing zarzuelas. He's hearing the music of Grieg at a concert that sent him in the direction of classical music. Here is Stephen Osborne with Juanjo Mena. Join the BBC Philharmonic in Manuel de Falla's Nights in the Gardens of Spain.
Thank you.
Stephen Osborne playing Nights in the Gardens of Spain by Manuel de Falla. Juanjo Mena conducting the BBC Philharmonic. And so after the feverish swirling of long skirts, heel stamping and fluttering fans, the work subsides to the calm of the beautiful gardens in which it inhabits, in Generalife and in Cordoba. Strings of the BBC Philharmonic evoking the strumming of guitars, a technique that Falla was taught by Philippe Pedrel, father figure of Spanish nationalist composers, the man who taught Albéniz and Granados as well. Stephen Osborne alone now at the front of the stage. His most recent solo recording is of the music of Ravel, including the original piano version of Alborada del Gracioso, which we heard earlier on. It's on the Chandos record label. He's joining in the applause now for sections of the orchestra, and Jomena now bringing the entire BBC Philharmonic to its feet. There is rather a Spanish feeling to the Royal Albert Hall to look at as well this evening, with the red velvet curtains of the boxes and the curve feeling a little like the arena of a bullfighting stadium. Now, in a celebrated essay, Falla conceded that even though Debussy had only visited Spain once and then on a day trip, he'd still managed to write genuinely Spanish music. His way, Falla claimed, was truth without authenticity, something that perhaps Falla achieved himself in Nights in the Gardens of Spain. Well, it's with more of Debussy's truths that we're going to finish tonight's prom. We've heard his image evoking the spirit of Britain and France. We finish with the largest and grandest of the set, Iberia. Well, on stage, the strings of the BBC Philharmonic have cleared a path for the piano to be wheeled off. So before we hear Iberia, an opportunity to meet tonight's conductor, the BBC Phil's new chief conductor, Juanjo Mena. I spoke to the Basque musician earlier on and asked him, first of all, why he'd chosen tonight's programme.
I think it's because it's one of the best periods in the music, also for a Spanish composer or the academic and new language in French, but also it's the same to the French that take the character of the Spain to his music, you know. And I think at the end, in the concert today, we can listen in really the same idea with different composers, no? Because when you take, for example, Alborada del Gracioso, you can see also Falla there, and if you take some things of Debussy, it's also Falla there. And I think it's a beautiful combination.
You're interviewed in the programme tonight, and you say that while Ravel and Debussy looked to Spain for influence, Falla, as a Spanish composer, was actually looking the other way. There's a lot of French in his evocation of Spain.
It's true, because in this time in Spain, before Falla, there's really no tradition about composers, no? In these strong moments for Spain, with the war and with the dictature, and people search something outside, and the near is French. And we discovered there one of the best moments for French, with the Impressionist moment, no? And I think this is an unbelievable combination.
You're the new chief conductor of the BBC Philharmonic, replacing Gianandrea Nozeda. Under his regime, we heard lots of Italian music. Under Jean-Pascal Tortelier, who was before Nozeda, we heard lots of French music. Are we now going to hear a lot of Spanish music with you in charge in Manchester?
Yeah, of course. I love Spanish music. I know very well, and I have now a wonderful instrument also to build a good repertory with better conditions also than before for me. And it's really exciting, and I will try to enter in on this music with a lot of respect. And I am really excited because I know very well this, and I think I can offer this. Also, in the same way, this program, no, it's also this way of I love French music, but at the same time, I love German music. Okay, we will see what happens.
And here you are at the proms, making your debut at the proms, but this is going to become a home from home now. Summers are going to be focused around here with the BBC Phil for you.
Yeah, I think it's the best moment to be here with them, because it's my debut, but it's with them, and they are in his home, too. And I will feel one orchestra really quiet, really helping, and I think we can do a good concert, and I think we will enjoy. It's a big honor also to be with this orchestra here. This is unbelievable. You have the best festival in the world.
That is certainly our message already. Juanjo Mena making his Brahms debut tonight with the BBC Philharmonic, and shortly to return to the stage to conduct Iberia from Debussy's Image. The piano's gone now, by the way. The string players are back in their seats and any second now, expecting the orchestra to begin tuning. Iberia may be one movement of the set, but in its own right it stands out as one of Debussy's most brilliant and successful compositions. Even if he did only visit Spain once to attend a bullfight in San Sebastian across the border from his home in the Pyrenees, he managed perfectly to encapsulate in music the associations that the country had in his mind. Iberia itself has three movements: In the Streets and Byways, The Fragrance of the Night, and The Morning of the Day of the Festival. Work started life as a piece for two pianos. As he orchestrated it, he set out to move further away from the impressionism that had characterized much of his earlier work. Roger Nichols, writing in the program tonight, says that means the opening of the piece has an impact and stridency that's new in Debussy's music, validating his claim that he was now dealing with realities. As the premiere of the piece was rehearsed, Debussy was delighted with the way it was coming to life. With people and things waking up, he said, there's a man selling watermelons and urchins whistling, and I can see them quite clearly. Well, there's almost a sort of Hollywood magic in the lushness of the central movement, and then comes a finale, wrote Debussy with some delight, that sounds as though it's improvised. Juanjo Mena returns to the stage for the last time this evening to conduct the BBC Philharmonic in Iberia from Debussy's Image.
Thank you.
So the sun has risen on the morning of the day of the festival. The last movement of Iberia from Debussy's Image. We've heard the whole set, all three pieces of Debussy's great triptych in tonight's prom. Yuri Toczynski, leader of the BBC Philharmonic, takes a bow. Juan Homena, chief conductor, brings oboe player Jill Callow to her feet. Richard Davis, principal flautist. John Bradby, who played that clarinet solo. Starts in the streets and byways, and then we encounter the fragrance of the night, a movement that Falia likened to the intoxicating smell of Andalusian nights, marked slow and dreamlike, yet with such richness to the woodwind and the muted brass, glittering through a shimmering tapestry of sound. Jamie Proffitt, principal trumpet, and the whole brass section now standing. Gabriel Piene, who conducted the premiere of Iberia, and it's Piene's music that features on Juan Homena's first disc with the BBC Philharmonic, which is out now on the Chandos record label. Well, that's the first visit of the season to the proms by the BBC Philharmonic. Juan Homena becomes its chief conductor officially in September. The orchestra's next two appearances here under the direction of their outgoing chief, Jan Andrea Nazeda, an all-Rachmaninoff programme, including the Bells on Sunday, July the 31st. That's a week on Sunday. And then a week on Monday, August the 1st, Stephen Huff joins the orchestra to play Saint-Saëns' fifth piano concerto. And the BBC Phil will be back under Vasily Sinaisky on the 11th of August, playing an English programme, Bridge, Holst and Elgar. So to loud cheers, Juan Homena, the BBC Phil's new Basque chief conductor, returns to the stage. I wonder what glorious Spanish treats are going to be in store in the years ahead here at the BBC Proms and also in Manchester at the Bridgewater Hall and at Media City, the orchestra's new home in Salford. Well, it's the Human Planet Prom here tomorrow night at 7:30. The BBC Concert Orchestra, alongside musicians from Papua New Guinea, Mongolia, Greenland and Zambia. That's tomorrow night. Verdi's Requiem on Sunday. For now, though, from the Royal Albert Hall, good night. Back to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House.
Petrarch, thank you very much indeed. Petrarch Trelawney, live at the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's fragrant Spanish prom. Well, you can enjoy that concert again if you'd like to by listening to Radio 3 on Monday afternoon. We're repeating the prom at 2 o'clock that day. Or indeed, you can go to the BBC Radio 3 website and listen to it again anytime you'd like to for the next 7 days. Also, over the weekend, there's a chance to hear the first of the BBC Proms chamber concerts, which took place at Cadogan Hall on Monday. Mahan Esfahani gave a recital on the harpsichord. It was a performance of the Goldberg Variations by Bach. The first edition of those pieces declared that they were composed for music lovers to refresh their spirits. Well, it certainly did mine. I listened to that concert on Monday afternoon as I drove through the Welsh marches and down through the Malvern Hills. It was a perfect accompaniment to such a landscape. So I can vouch personally for a worthwhile appointment for 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. Well worth a listen. This coming Monday, by the way, we'll be live at Cadogan Hall again to hear the clarinetist Julian Bliss and the Elias Quartet playing music by Purcell and Brahms, and also a brand new BBC commission by Sally Beamish, the world premiere of her third string quartet. The BBC Proms Chamber Music live here on BBC Radio 3 on Monday lunchtime at 1 o'clock. Well, back to tonight, and in 20 minutes' time, an invitation to Whiteway in Gloucestershire, which became home to a community that sought to live life according to principles set down by the Russian writer Leo Tolstoy. What happened to it, though? Did it survive? And who did the washing up? As you'll discover, that question became rather pivotal in its history. Tolstoy in the Cotswolds is at 10 o'clock tonight here on Radio 3. Then we really go international. We have the last of this week's postcards from Istanbul, sent tonight by Maureen Freely, who both loves the city and hates it. She grew up there. You can hear her reasons at 10:45 tonight in our essay. And that's followed by music from Hungary and performances by young musicians set on keeping their Slavic musical traditions alive, all in World on 3 at 11 o'clock tonight. Now, The Proms on Sunday, a major work by a composer who wrote a set of pieces he called The Four Seasons. Not perhaps his best-known work, so I'm not talking here about Vivaldi. I'm referring to the man who wrote the Requiem we're going to hear on Sunday, Giuseppe Verdi.
Thank you.
The first of a set of four pieces Verdi called his Four Seasons. That was Winter, and it was played by the orchestra of the Bologna Opera, conducted by Riccardo Chailly. Well, on Sunday, Semyon Bychkov will conduct a performance of Verdi's Requiem. The soloists will join forces with the BBC Symphony Chorus and that of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, and it's the BBC Symphony Orchestra that'll play the music. It all begins live here on BBC Radio 3 on Sunday evening at 7 o'clock. And do have a listen to a rather revealing in-depth interview with Semyon Bychkov on the Radio 3 website. It was the first of this season's Lebrecht interviews, which we broadcast here on Radio 3 last week. You can hear the next in the series on Monday evening, by the way, at 9 o'clock. Norman Lebrecht will be talking to one of the leading lights in the music world, the Chief Executive Officer of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, Deborah Border. That's at 9 o'clock on Monday. Well, it's just coming up to 10 to 10. Let's go back to the music now. And having heard one of Verdi's Four Seasons, I thought we could turn to the music of the man who made such a title world famous, though this is not one of Vivaldi's seasons. This is one of his 12 concertos, known collectively as La Stravaganza. This is the eighth of them. It's played by Rachel Podger and Arte dei Suonatori. Thank you. The eighth of the 12 concertos by Vivaldi called La Stravaganza. Rachel Podger was the solo violinist there. She directed Arte dei Suonatori. One of the composers featured in this year's proms season here on Radio 3 is Liszt, a formidable pianist and a musician who turned as much to the music of others as to the music of his own to make his name. He transcribed many an orchestral piece, for instance, perhaps most famously the music of his son-in-law Richard Wagner. But he also created powerful piano versions of many songs, including those of Franz Schubert. In fact, he made over 50 arrangements of Schubert Lieder, helping to spread Schubert's name way after his death. Or perhaps the most famous one is the story of the father and the son encountering the Erl King. The father's narrative is played out on the bass line in big octaves, and the terrified child is depicted up on the soprano line. But listen to how the chords start to spread gradually throughout the piece, depicting the Erl King. Plenty of terror in this performance. This is Murray Pariah. stuff of nightmares. Murray Pirai playing Liszt's transcription of Schubert's famous song of the Erl King. We're off to the Cotswolds in just a moment on Radio 3 in the company of Tolstoy.
On BBC Radio 3 from the 2011 Proms, a musical celebration of a great television event. Earlier this year, Human Planet brought to our screens some of the diverse cultures of the world with a musical soundtrack by Nitin Sawhney.
It was inspired by these incredible images, and I think if you write music that's inspired by incredible visuals, inevitably the music works in itself.
You can hear excerpts from Nitin Sawhney's score and also some of the performers heard in Radio 3's accompanying Music Planet series. A memorable Saturday night at the BBC Proms on BBC Radio 3 from 7:30.
Well, now on BBC Radio 3, Tolstoy in the Cotswolds. For the 100th anniversary of the great writer's death last year, the historian Mike Berlin visited Whiteway, a hidden Gloucestershire village which reveals Tolstoy's continuing legacy far beyond Russia.
A dance now from the Gloucestershire village of Leddington. This dance is called William and Nancy.
On an early autumn day, as the Morris men dance, Whiteway Village in Gloucestershire seems like any other English village celebrating its annual fete.
Intend to have another go?
Yes. Yes, I might as well.
There's a big queue
that came out. 663!
But Whiteway is not like any other English village.
It's a strange, magical place, Whiteway. It seems to have a closeness, and there seems to be something spiritual here as well.
My mum can remember people coming with coach trips and looking at these strange people who lived in Whiteway. And people used to throw them sweets, and that was all right.
There's a lot of alternative medicine practice here. I mean, I do Reiki, and somebody else does homeopathy, and there's another couple which do cranial sacral therapy.
We are different from other places.
I think the outside world think that we're all naturists, and nudists are strange up there.
Whiteway was historically thought of as peculiar because they didn't have the Victorian dress. They took on a more practical mode of dress for gardening and working the land.
White Stilton with apricots, an ordinary cheddar, blue Stilton, red Leicester, and double Gloucester.
Whiteway Village, or Colony, as it is more properly named, is an odd collection of houses, reminiscent of Kansas homesteads or Russian dachas, resting in high ground in the South Cotswolds, not far from Stroud. The founders of this singular community were the English followers of Leo Tolstoy, who died 100 years ago. Sharing a bread and cheese lunch in the home of Chris and Richard England seemed like a perfect starting point for looking at Tolstoy's English legacy, not least because Chris is the colony's secretary.
We are responsible for everything that we own, but nobody owns anything individually. It's all communally owned. We've got our own playing field, our own swimming pool, our own hall. We maintain our own roads. So that to function here, everything has to have an input from everybody here. And to administer the land, we have our monthly colony meeting, which we have to have to maintain the right to administer the land the way we do. So we decide who is going to live here. You are, in effect, voted in. You can buy the house. The house is yours. What you do on that with your house is entirely your decision. But the land remains everybody's. And so you are allocated your plot for your use and occupation for your lifetime. Once you've gone, it goes back to the colony. and then whoever buys the house can apply for the house. We manage our own finances to maintain White Way House, to maintain the roads. We fundraise a lot, like we have our fete. So we're pretty much independent of everybody around us.
So we're here in your house, which was originally the house of Nellie Shaw. Nellie was one of the founders of the White Way Colony, and she had a free union with Francis Sedlak, who is a Czech philosopher, and he's a direct connection with Tolstoy because he had visited Russia before he came here and met Tolstoy. So there's a very direct connection between your house and Tolstoy. I'm wondering, are you as colonists aware of that legacy? Do you know about Tolstoy? Are you interested in Tolstoy?
Yes, the link to Tolstoy we do feel. I mean, he was obviously a strange man in that what he wanted, what he needed in his life, what he preached and how he actually lived his life didn't always quite tally. But what we've got here, we want to share with others. And if it's not quite the Tolstoy thing, it doesn't matter. Everything evolves, everything moves on. So if we're part of this evolution, fine.
Why were these colonies founded? And what were their links to Tolstoy's philosophy? Michael Holman taught Russian studies at the University of Leeds.
Tolstoy's philosophy entailed essentially a recognition of what he referred to as the universal law of love that he found in all great religions. How he came to take on this view, I think you have to go back into his own personal life. He was a man who had, by the age of 50, written what are probably two of the greatest novels in world literature, War and Peace and Anna Karenina. He was living in very comfortable circumstances, and I think he was concerned about what do I do with my life now? And he came to what one might say is a midlife crisis.
Rosamund Bartlett, the author of a new biography, thinks that the roots of these ideas went right back to Tolstoy's early adult life, and sees the origins of his ideas in the great novels, such as in the character of Konstantin Levin in Anna Karenina.
Tolstoy fought in the Crimean War, and the experience of fighting alongside rank-and-file soldiers made him see, for the first time, the huge gap between his own very privileged aristocratic status and that of the Russian peasant. And it planted this seed in him, which was to grow into this extraordinary movement later on. And he followed up this experience fighting in Sebastopol by going on to try and plan a reform of the Russian army, for example. And he starts wanting to liberate his serfs long time before the Emancipation Act in 1861. But then, you know, he was also a very mercurial man, and then suddenly he just went and got married. And that actually turned him from this path to becoming a writer again. And he ended up writing War and Peace and Anna Karenina. But in some important senses, he was actually turning away from the main path that he was on, which was to live a life that was consonant with his ethical religious principles.
He went to the Bible, and in the Bible he homed in on the New Testament, and the New Testament he homed in on the Sermon on the Mount. And out of that he distilled five precepts. Four were don't, and one was do. The first was don't be angry. The second was don't lust. The third was don't swear oaths, and by that he meant don't commit yourself now to future activity by saying you will, signing a document. The fourth was don't resist him that's evil, and that led to a doctrine of non-resistance. And the fifth was the positive one, and that was love your enemies. Essentially, it was a philosophy of improving the individual. It was a religious attitude to life, and it was a Christianity that was shorn of all mysticism, had no connection with the Orthodox Church itself at all. It was related to the individual's attitude towards God and the individual's attitude towards himself or herself. And therefore it didn't, in its essence like that, had any social content at all. But the social implications, if you tried to live
like that were fearful, tremendous, life-shattering.
The impact of his ideas for Russian and other readers was profound. A movement of followers soon started, determined to live out Tolstoy's principles.
The first Tolstoyan communities were established in the mid-1880s, almost immediately after his writing started being circulated illegally. And the kinds of people who set them up were actually, by and large, not peasants, but members of the intelligentsia. They were from the educated classes. For example, there was one Prince Hilkov, Dmitry Hilkov, who abandoned his ancestral home and lived in a little izba, a little hut, in the middle of his land, and he gave the land to the peasants. And it was all about working the land, doing manual labour. So Tolstoy really believed in the fact that one should earn one's daily bread. But I have to say that he didn't like the idea of it being an organisation.
So Tolstoy was not Tolstoy.
He was an anarchist.
He was not Tolstoyan. He wasn't.
He hated the idea of it being a proper sort of organisation.
I'm Joy Thacker and I've been living here 43 years. It was our first home and we've been here ever since. My father was a coal merchant and he had delivered coal to the house where this old lady lives, where we live now. She wanted to move away and he'd drawn us a map on the back of an old envelope. And we came on a bank holiday Monday, all drippy, it had been raining, and the moment we walked up the path, I knew I wanted to stay. And I've never felt any different, actually, ever.
Over a century later, White Way is living proof that Tolstoy's philosophy did result in a proper sort of organisation.
When we went first to our house, we had one cold running tap and an Elson. Mm-hmm. We didn't have anything. Mm-hmm. And we spent that, and it was 2.5 years before we had a toilet. That's why I'm obsessed with toilets, because we had a blue plastic bucket that we'd been given as a wedding present with a lid on. And we used that all that while until we dug our septic tank and all that. And then I told you another year we had the whole roof off and I had to go to bed in coats and no heating. And I had three little children then, and that wasn't a joke. But it doesn't hurt us. It doesn't hurt.
That the object of life is self-perfecting, the perfection.
So how did Tolstoy's philosophy come to Britain? It's exciting to hear him speaking his own words in this early recording. But it was publishing which played the key role in disseminating his thought. The first philosophical works were becoming available at the same time that his novels were being translated and eagerly read in English. One of the first followers of Tolstoy's philosophy in this country was his translator and friend, the carpet importer Aylmer Maud, while Tolstoy's acolyte, Vladimir Chertkov, who had fled to England, set up the Free Age Press.
They produced over 3 years something like 450 million pages of Tolstoyan and kindred literature. Hundreds and hundreds of pamphlets. All of these things produced with no rights reserved. The first big novel Tolstoy wrote after his change, Resurrection, that was published by the Brotherhood Publishing Company in penny parts. And because of some of the descriptions of sexual matters, it was the Quakers were much against it, and W. H. Smith wouldn't have it sold in London. Of course, when a novel is forbidden by W. H. Smith, it receives even greater publicity, and so then everybody wanted to read it. But these little booklets are very difficult to find now. They were cheaply produced. They were paperback, green. The beginning of paperbacks, bringing Tolstoy and literature to the broad masses. I think this is what was necessary. Anna Karenina, War and Peace, are not for the broad masses, but this kind of literature, the pamphlets, certainly. Well,
copies of Tolstoy's banned works were smuggled back to Russia, while in Britain, such ideas were increasingly finding a receptive audience. Charlotte Alston from the University of Northumbria.
Well, the major group in Britain is the Croydon Brotherhood group, led by John Kenworthy, but with a fairly wide membership. And they start off really working on kind of small-scale cooperative projects, quite closely tied into other cooperative movements as well. They become much closer to Tolstoy because Kenworthy has correspondence with him and I think is very taken with the idea that they might be carrying forward Tolstoy's work in England. And you can see a kind of gradual change in what they do from the sort of city-based cooperative projects towards this kind of back-to-the-land, bread-labour focus, which eventually results in the foundation of their colony, which is at Purley in Essex.
What were these urban cooperative efforts at Croydon, what form did they take?
In Croydon, they had a dressmaking enterprise. You could buy suits that had been cooperatively produced and tailored for you. They had a little bookstore, and you could also go, there would be, you know, meetings at the bookstore where you could go and talk to like-minded people. There was a rambling club at one point. There are youth groups, and eventually there's a school which is being run on Tolstoyan principles.
So at its height, the Purley colony is founded.
Yeah, but there are other groups all over the UK, really, in Leeds, in Blackburn, in Derby, in Manchester, there's a Tolstoy Society. Whether they take the form of sort of small communal enterprises or publishing houses or a few individuals who publish a newspaper, it has quite a broad geographical base, I would say, in the UK. And then from Purley, the White Way colony, which is pretty much the only one that still physically exists, is founded.
So, Joy, you're going to take us around to some of the important points in the village, starting with White Way House. Why are we starting here?
Well, White Way House was the headquarters of the early pioneers, and there were about 10 of them. The land they bought was 42 acres, and they bought it because there was water here, and there was this one building here. It's a shepherd's cottage. It's got four rooms, an attic and a cellar, and it wasn't actually large enough to house all the early pioneers. They were all single people, men and women. And so the ones who couldn't live here lived elsewhere, and every day they would walk up and share in the land work, equally men and women together, everything. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, if they could, and it was fine, they would sit out in the garden and have a meal. And if you were walking up that road there, which is a parish road that is right on the edge of here, they would invite you to have a meal with them.
The building does stand out, doesn't it, from all the other buildings we're going to see?
Oh yes, it's completely different because it's built in the traditional Cotswold way, whereas the other ones are wooden buildings. I mean, most of them are wooden buildings, but not all. Some were made from asbestos. Some are quite solid now and quite modern looking. I think they wanted bungalows in those early days because they laid low and they weren't going to stand it on the landscape, because you've got to know that in those early days this was just two bare fields. There were no trees, and some of these early buildings were maybe a chicken hut. These were poor people who came here, so they could be seen, and people used to actually come up here in charabangs in those days, of course, 1898 in that time, and they would drive through to look and see these strange people who weren't dressed in corsets and long skirts like Victorians and Edwardians were. They were now in shift dresses with their hair loose, and men with shorts on and sandals. Great sign of liberation, always sandals.
This was, of course, at a time when many British people were ready for change. Gillian Darley's book, Villages of Vision, explores the history of the search for the Arcadian ideal.
This huge wheel had turned in the 19th century, dragging people into the city from 1 million to 10 million in the middle of the 19th century and on up from there. So I suppose what you're seeing by the 1880s and 1890s is any kind of way of breaking away from that. So you might have Ashby taking his Guild of Handicrafts from East End out to a much more congenial place in the Cotswolds. But the whole idea of returning to somewhere that was more salubrious was part of it. And then, of course, the self-determination of this particular move, the fact that they were doing it as a community with a shared objective, was, again, something not new, but perhaps pronounced by the circumstances that they were born of, the hardship, the urban poverty, the overcrowding, the general misery of especially London.
I think the late 1890s in England was a period of rapid industrial expansion, development of trade union movements, the development of the Independent Labour Party under Keir Hardie, which had very little to do with Marxism and much more to do with Christian pacifism at the time, the development of the Fabians. There were large engineering strikes, there were industrial strikes, and people, I think, were fed up now with the Victorian period and were searching for some alternative way out. And suddenly here comes this Russian, and he seems to have answers to problems. Answers on an individual level, but follow that individual level through, and it has huge, as I said earlier, it has huge social implications. So I think the ground was right, and so I think they picked this up of some alternative way. Some people refer to Tolstoyism as the third way, One way is the established government. The other way is Marxism. And the third way is a Tolstoyan way, which is based on man's inner spirit.
Would you characterize it as a kind of anti-industrialism, millenarian in some sense?
Yeah. But there have been these movements back to the land, you know, going back hundreds and hundreds of years. We haven't mentioned the diggers, but I suppose the diggers was exactly the same. Mm. And they've talked about the Tolstoyans in the early days that they thought that kingdom of God lay at the end of a spade, that one could dig one's way through to salvation and the kingdom of God.
That could almost come out of Wind Stanley.
Yes, exactly.
Just imagine if you were very poor, and I have got these letters of application at home, and one of them goes a bit like this. I live in London with my wife in a basement room. She isn't very well. Please could we be granted just a small piece of land on which to put a building and grow a few crops? What a wonderful dream.
So, Joy, you've taken me to the edge of the colony, just outside the Colony Hall, and we're looking across a newly ploughed field, a beautiful sweep of land. On the horizon are a stand of trees, and it's a stunning autumn afternoon. It's very warm, very beautiful, fluffy clouds in the sky. It's almost what any tourist brochure would think of as being the Cotswolds of England. Isn't it sort of strange that this should also be the place that the ideas of Tolstoy were implanted?
Yes, I suppose it is, really, but you've got to remember they had to come somewhere where they could afford actually to live. They didn't choose a very good place, even though you described it so beautifully, really, because the soil is absolutely awful. But I wonder if people really felt it was maybe the new way forward or not.
Well, that must have been, at least for the people who started it, what they thought at the beginning of the last century. They were starting a new century and indeed reading newspapers such as The New Age and thinking ahead. And they thought working communally and no ownership of the land and no money and free unions and pacifism and vegetarianism was the future.
Yes. Yes, I'm certain of that.
To celebrate this new freedom and to show that they were truly following Tolstoy's philosophy, they agreed upon a symbolic gesture of huge significance, as Chris England admits.
The burning of the deeds was because they did not want specific land ownership. Nobody should own land. So when they bought the land, there were sort of a few of them that signed the papers, but none of them wanted ownership. So they stuck them on a pitchfork and put them over the bonfire, up on the green up here. When the plots were divided, it was okay. You handed a bit to your brother or your children or whatever. But when land registry came in, none of these plots are registered with land registry. The colony is not registered at all. The downside of this is that if you want to buy a house here, because there are no deeds, you cannot get a mortgage. So it has to be a cash sale. But this does exclude pretty much younger people, family people coming here to live.
I'm certainly drawn to the most radical interpretation of community. I always find the more radical, the more interesting they are. And certainly, you know, putting your title deeds on a pitchfork and burning it is about as radical as you come. The trouble is that you get unintended consequences of that radicalism.
Tobias Jones has a personal interest in alternative communities. He researched them for his book Utopian Dreams and is currently setting one up himself.
I think the sort of living without rules is quite a, you know, that's obviously one of the aspirations of communal living, that we're going to live outside the sort of narrow etiquette and narrow-mindedness of society in general, but actually you're still going to need structure and hierarchy and leadership and the organisation.
And what happens if you don't have these?
When you look in communities, there are usually three reasons they fall down, and it's money, the washing up, and sex. And actually, if you want a community to survive, you've got to deal with those three in some way.
And so White Way faced these dilemmas of collective ownership and of communal living. And then, of course, there was the so-called SQ, the sex question, as discussed in a delightful book by early settler Nellie Shaw, the original resident of Chris and Richard England's plot. Early scandals over free unions between couples and allegations of skinny dipping and disputes over property quickly forced the colony to adapt its ideals. Joy, we've been walking through these lovely covered hedgerows and dense foliage. Was Whiteway like this when it started?
No, there weren't any hedges at all. It was completely open, bare, quite high up, 800 feet above sea level. In those very early days, any crops that were above the soil really didn't stand much of a chance. And so that was another reason why the early white winds were a bit depleted and had to change tack.
Why or when did the hedges go up and the properties get divided?
I think they started to go up really when they wanted to go into what I call individual living, when they put their own buildings up on land which was allocated to them at the Conwy meeting.
And did that mean that the spirit of the place was changing, and was it a very important change?
Well, I suppose when you do have fences, it is a bit of a barrier. But in those days, remember that everybody had to walk for their water, and so they would meet each other quite a bit, you know, just simply doing those ordinary tasks.
Right.
This moment in Whiteway's history, in the years around Tolstoy's death, were being played out against a backdrop of growing social unrest in Britain and in Russia. During the Great War, Whiteway welcomed young men seeking shelter from the carnage of the trenches. Meanwhile, in Russia, the upheavals of 1917 led to an outpouring of communal experiments along Tolstoyan lines. It was inevitable that such similar British schemes would be associated with the Russian Revolution. Indeed, Nelly Shaw actually referred to Whiteway as an experiment in communist living.
Yeah, well, I would prefer not to call them communists. I would prefer to call them communists. You can't make that distinction. But I think when we talk about them as being communists, communists we associate with Marx. There's no Marx in them. Some of them may have read Marx. But Marx was essentially concerned with social reform and not the reform of the human spirit, whereas they were concerned with the reform of the human soul, the human spirit, and changing man's attitude towards himself and others. And that had an effect on the community. They started with the individual, and they lived in a commune in order to be communards or communists, so that together they would agree on the right way to go ahead. And their living in a commune didn't mean that they exploited anybody.
It's time!
As we continued our tour, Joy Thacker suggested that we stop in on one of the oldest residents, another Joy, Joy Evans, who is now 86 and has lived at Whiteway ever since she was a child. She lived through the years when Whiteway was a haven for conscientious objectors, anarchists, and other political refugees, attracting the attention of the security services, whose paid informants compiled an extensive file on what was then thought to be a hotbed of sexual license and political subversion.
We had a folk dance group, we had a ballroom dancing group, we had a group that were very interested in playing cards, so we had a regular whist drive, and we nearly always, every winter, we had a WEA class. There was always something going on. All the adults were aunts and uncles, and there were very little barriers between the plots of land that people held. And we used to go around. We knew it wasn't done to go and walk on people's gardens and do things like that, but we could always go and knock on the door and, you know, say hello. And various people were very good to us, and they gave us a little treat of some sort or told us a story. You know, I mean, everyone was very friendly. It was a big family.
This program's about Leo Tolstoy and his 100th anniversary of his death in 1910. And the colony was founded, as you know, in 1898 by people who were influenced by his ideas. Do you feel that, in your experience of living here, that some of his ideas have informed your life here?
Oh, certainly. I mean, the main idea that one shouldn't own land and it should be used by the people who live there. And then when they move on, it should be used by someone else. I mean, this is the thing that keeps us together, really. That basic principle. Otherwise, we're very free to do and think as we like.
And when you've been in your life here, Joy, was there a good relationship with the outside world, or was the difference too great? Was there a sense of separateness?
In the early days, there was definitely a set of separateness. But we used to have a school here, and the children, young people, used to be taught up here. But when our numbers dropped so much, we couldn't keep the school running. So most of the children went either to Missenden, or some of them went to Birdlip, some of them went to Sheepscombe, and some of them went into a small school in Stroud. So then because of the children, we really began to get integrated in the local population much more.
And over the years, there have been quite a few interesting visitors and temporary colonists who've come and gone. Do you remember the refugees from the Spanish Civil War? Mm-hmm. Must have been interesting for you and for the rest of the community to play host to this group of Spanish...
Yes, I know. It was. Well, as you say, we were host to them. But I think there was some organisation in London which sent some money down, but mostly their needs were met by the community here. I know one of the things that my mother did every Saturday, she would go into Gloucester, and most Saturdays she would pick up a pig's head, which would then be brought home and it'd be cooked up to make a brawn for them down there. There were about 10 of them, I think.
There were 10. Yeah.
10, that's right.
Not vegetarian, obviously.
No, they weren't vegetarian. Well, that was one of the things up here. A lot of the people were vegetarians, but a lot of the people weren't.
White Way survived as a physical unit, a group of people who shared principles or shared ideas, living at a particular place, because they, in fact, abandoned many of the extreme principles that they had before. They abandoned, for example, the non-use of money, or enough of them abandoned it in order to enable it to survive. They didn't all do anything at any one time, but there was enough common sense to say, look, if we go on doing this, we're not going to be here much longer, so we'll have to change. They didn't abandon the non-payment of taxes, the non-payment, that was a terrible problem for them all, the non-payment of their rates. So they had to come to some compromise. Very often, as happened with the Quakers, there would be some other person who wasn't involved in the community who would come out of the woodwork and pay it for them. Now, if you were a man of or a woman of great principle, say, no, I'm not going to have it paid. I will go and I'll serve time in prison. And some of them did that. It was a question of not recognising the state power. And that goes off into all kinds of areas. Mm. I mean, also not going to do any military service, are you?
Yes. And this leads to a very important point, I think, because the whole notion of conscientious objectors in both the First and Second World Wars is a very important part of British social history.
Yeah.
Can you discuss the connections between Tolstoyan ideas and the establishment of the right of individuals not to fight?
Tolstoy himself was a supporter of soldiers in Russia who'd been maltreated. He's written quite a lot about that. And in England, people who were involved in the fight for the recognition of the individual's right not to serve arms or to do alternative service or not to serve in the armed forces, there were many Tolstoyans who were involved in that fight early on, because it emerges out of the same kind of right of the individual on a moral and religious ground to say, that is not the way I would do things. My father was a conscience objector in the last war on Christian pacifist grounds. He lived in a semi-commune, and the other man in this group said, I'll take orders from anybody, but I won't tell anybody to do anything. So there are different ways of compromising. Mm-hmm. Some people go further. My father believed in work on the land, and he went on in a market garden working after the war on that. Mm-hmm. So the right not to give the government everything is, I think, really what we've fought for, and we pride ourselves on it in England, saying we are big enough to support that alternative view of life. In Russia, it's always been very difficult. Mm. Russia is far more absolutist, and you have to find a different way of resisting the state. The best way to do it in the past was to go to Siberia without being sent there.
Which, poignantly, is precisely what the Tolstoyans were trying to do in early Soviet Russia.
They had lived these model communist lives. They'd actually set up these colonies in the 1920s, thinking, at last, you know, this is the golden age of Tolstoyanism, and we can actually put into practice our beliefs and no one's going to persecute us. But actually, it was very naive to think that the Bolshevik government was going to allow this. And so they eventually petitioned to set up a colony in Siberia. And again, it was like in the old days, they thought they'd be safe on the periphery. But actually, there was no spot in the entire Soviet Union that was safe in the 1930s. And eventually, the men got rounded up and sent to the camps, and the colony disintegrated, you know, because there was this sort of order that they had to be collectivized. And eventually, the movement almost fizzled out.
So what you're saying is that what was impossible under Stalin, under a totalitarian system, actually paradoxically was able to continue and had a life far removed from that in the Gloucestershire countryside.
Yes, well, in England, people are much more moderate, aren't they?
When I first came to Whiteway, this sign seemed to me to say a lot about Whiteway, because this is the community sports field.
Yes.
And there's a hand-painted sign which says, "Dog owners, please clean up if your dog fouls the sports field. Toxocara canis may cause blindness." Now, in no municipal playing field anywhere in Britain will you have the Latin name of the disease which dog mess can cause. And I think that says a lot about Whiteway. It's giving a very good reason why you dogs shouldn't foul. Do you think that's true?
Well, you see, we're close and we have these meetings, and they can, you know, everybody says their bit. And if people think that there is dog mess, then a letter goes round or somebody goes and sees the people. It's always been like that.
Oh yeah, here's the colony notice board. And indeed, there's a advert up for Russian language classes. There's also a notice which is a gentle reminder that hedges now need cutting so that the oil companies can deliver before winter, which is also interesting. And there's a sign for a meditation group and a transition away from oil. Current projects, community orchard, bulk food purchase, sourcing local foods, time banking, sustainable energy sourcing, grants. So there's a lot going on.
Yes, we're certainly not back in the past too much.
No.
Gillian Darley believes that this forward-looking aspect of a community, which might appear to be backward-looking, was there from the very start.
They were very proud of what they were doing. It played to all sorts of people's skills. So there were things that people did there that in the long run became of great use to people locally, so that, you know, they weren't in a bubble. They certainly thought they were avant-garde rather than looking through any kind of backward look. So I think that does mark them out. Is quite different from, in a way, the Guild of Handicraft. I mean, the Guild of Handicraft was a different way of doing now, but I think the Tolstoyan Anarchists was a different way of doing tomorrow.
This progressive experiment has adapted to wider social changes. The older communalism survives in attenuated form, and now Whiteway is one of the last links with the Tolstoyan past. Does this story of change and adaptation mean that it was a failure?
I don't think the success of a community should necessarily be judged by whether it lasts for eternity. I think they probably do have a natural lifespan. And what often happens is that there's a very charismatic visionary pioneer or founder who, when either he dies or leaves, or unfortunately often runs off with one of the attractive volunteers who comes to the community 10 years down the line, the whole thing falls apart because he or she was the person who held the place together. What would interest me more than the longevity of the actual communities is the way the torches pass from one to another, so that actually Tolstoy, who passed the torch to Gandhi, and Gandhi passed it on to many others. So if you take, for example, the peace people in Northern Ireland, you know, when three or four innocent children were killed in a chase and they wanted to start a peace movement. Coincidentally, the parish priest was absent and the priest who stepped in had been on mission with followers of Gandhi, and therefore the peace people in Northern Ireland became very much informed by Gandhi and Tolstoyan ideals. Completely different community to what was there 100 years before, but it's a similar motivation. And the other example is the community of the Ark in in South France, founded by the greatest Italian of the 20th century, Lanza del Vasto, who again had spent time in India, studied with Gandhi, was called Shantidas, servant of peace, and again working the land in peace and serenity to try and bring love to the world. You know, it's been through lean times and better times, and it may not last forever, but that's the torch being passed from person to person, or community to community, I suppose.
And so Tolstoy's ideas of nonviolence, of pacifist civil disobedience, extended beyond the bucolic confines of the English countryside. And it was through the translations of the English Tolstoyans that they had what was perhaps their greatest impact. Richard Sarabji of Wolfson College, Oxford, is currently writing a book on Gandhi.
Gandhi was first influenced by reading Tolstoy's book, The Kingdom of God is Within You, and it expressed the idea of nonviolence, which he really believed in. But what happened in 1908 was that he heard of Tolstoy having written something called Letter to a Hindu, which was direct advice on nonviolent resistance to the Indians under British rule. And he then wrote Tolstoy and asked his permission to publish it because it was only a manuscript. It transformed Gandhi's understanding because he calls himself a votary of violence until he read Tolstoy. He disapproved of the type of nonviolence he'd found in India. Then he read Tolstoy's book, and it says that nonviolence is an attitude of mind. It's an ocean of compassion. And that was a very, very different conception, and he absolutely loved it. Just a word on that nonviolence. It has two parts to it. The one we think of, because it had such a spectacular effect in resisting the British, is nonviolent resistance. But what he learnt from Tolstoy was that nonviolence is valuable for its own sake, even when there's no need any longer for resistance. Even when the British had stopped ruling India, everybody would need nonviolence because it's this attitude of love for all other human beings.
And how else do these ideas survive and adapt in the present day?
If you go back to the 60s, certainly there were all kinds of experiments in alternative societies then. If you move on now to kind of ecological movements, for example, Tolstoy's idea of bread labour and his idea of actually only consuming as much as you need for your own individual worth, this I would have thought is extraordinarily topical. Economists will say, that's nonsense, you can't do that. If you start consuming less, the whole of our society would actually collapse. So our society is actually based on increasing consumption. But there are always those who say there must be an alternative way. And those who believe in growing your own vegetables, living a little bit more off the land, not spending so much time in cities. You can't say that that is Tolstoyan, but it's the attitude towards the government of the individual and the right of the individual to do his or her thing in his own way, not forcing anybody else to do it, which I think continues the same kind of idea.
Homegrown tomatoes, of course.
Oh, yes.
And cucumber.
Sharing a meal at White Way, it is tempting to wonder what Tolstoy himself would have made of the place today. I have a sense that he would see as kindred spirits the warm and open residents that welcomed me, and he would be pleased that in the surrounding area his dream of a more simple, cooperative, and harmonious life is still being pursued.